Hello, hello, and welcome to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I am your host, Andrew Sweatman, and today we've got one review and two discussions, all of which I'm very excited about. First up, my review of the latest from the Coen brother, just one of them this time, Joel Coen, his latest film, The Tragedy of Macbeth. After that, filmmaker Clayton Henderson joins the show to talk about Red Rocket, the latest from director Sean Baker. And to wrap it all up, we continue our series entitled The Art of Deconstruction, Faith, Doubt, and Film. Bethany Werden is here to discuss her own faith and the 2016 Denis Villeneuve film, Arrival. Stick around.
By the pricking of my thumbs, something wicked this way comes.
My husband. King that shall be.
If we should fail.
We fail. Didst thou not hear noise?
Methought I heard a voice cry, sleep no more.
That was Denzel Washington himself as Macbeth in the new film from director Joel Coen, The Tragedy of Macbeth. The film also stars Frances McDormand as Lady Macbeth and an incredible performance by Catherine Hunter as all three of the Weird Sisters. Shakespearean film adaptations tend to have some sort of creative angle, like West Side Story is Romeo and Juliet, but with singing and dancing and rival New York gangs. Or 10 Things I Hate About You, it's The Taming of the Shrew, but set in high school. Or Baz Luhrmann's Romeo plus Juliet, which has a modern setting and a chaotic style, but interestingly retains the original Shakespearean language. This film, The Tragedy of Macbeth, keeps the original language and the original setting, but does some audacious things with the production design. The film has a bold visual style, clearly influenced by German Expressionism, filmed in black and white to accentuate the many sharp lines and angles visible in frame. The look of this film is incredibly memorable. Perhaps equally memorable are the performances from Denzel Washington and Frances McDormand, who look incredible in costume and have a strong command of the Shakespearean language. Denzel is at the exact right stage of his career for a role like this. His familiar but storied face and his naturally salt-and-pepper beard match the energy of the aging Macbeth really nicely. McDormand is also wonderful here, delivering all of her lines beautifully, including the famous soliloquy about the damned spot. By the way, if you're someone who is turned off by the idea of a film entirely made up of Shakespearean language, I would encourage you to give this a try anyway. An interesting thing happens when you listen for an extended period of time to dialogue that sounds a bit foreign to your ear. You start to pick up on other aspects of the performances, like body language and tone of voice. There's a famous quote from Alfred Hitchcock in which he said, quote, "If it's a good movie, the sound could go off and the audience would still have a perfectly clear idea of what was going on." I think a similar sentiment applies to a film with challenging language. If the director and the performers are doing their job, you still understand what's going on, even if you don't pick up on every word. I actually deliberated about this myself. Should I turn on subtitles to follow the language better, or leave them off and just try to feel what's going on when I miss little details? I opted to leave them off. Back on the subject of performances, I also have to mention Catherine Hunter, who plays all three of the Weird Sisters and is astonishing. She really goes all in on being weird. Since the witches transform into birds at various moments, she delivers many of her lines with a bird-like caw, and there are also moments of contortion while she's speaking. Every moment with the witches is very deliberately designed from a visual standpoint also. When Macbeth and Banquo initially meet them, they seem to exist only in the reflection of a small pool of water before materializing. And then later, during the famous double-double toil and trouble scene, they are hanging from rafters as they speak to Macbeth, and the entire floor of the room suddenly fills up with dark liquid to create the cauldron before draining away at the end of the scene. The film is full of immensely creative touches like this, but it's not so style-heavy that it drowns out the power of the original story. The emotional states of the characters really come through and create a moving and disturbing piece of film. By leaning into a distinct and creative vision for this material, director Joel Coen has created an unnerving and wholly unique Shakespearean adaptation that is visually breathtaking and features first-rate actors giving powerful and dazzling performances. I gave The Tragedy of Macbeth 4.5 out of 5 stars, and you can stream it now on Apple TV+.
Are you a man?
Aye, and a bold one, that dare look upon that which might appall the devil.
I have no words. My voice is in my sword.
When I'm watching a movie, I love to have a little snack. And I'm a big, big fan of popcorn. I recently discovered a company who makes popcorn I love so much, I decided to become an affiliate. So yes, this is an ad, but I will never try and sell you on something I don't love myself. The product is called OPopPop. They make flavor-wrapped popcorn kernels, which means you can get a variety of tasty flavors on your popcorn straight from the microwave without having to pop and season it yourself on the stove. It comes in savory and sweet flavors like salted umami, vanilla cake pop, Cinnalicious, which is like a cinnamon roll, and spicy cheddar. Right now, they also have some delicious holiday flavors, and you can try them all and get 10% off your first order by going to arthousegarage.com/popcorn. And the link is in the show notes. All right, back to the show. And now it's time for the first of two discussions on today's episode. Arkansas filmmaker Clayton Henderson is here to talk Red Rocket. Clayton's short film, called One of These Days, won the short competition this past year at the Filmland Festival. And after meeting him on Instagram, I could tell he's someone who loves watching and discussing movies. And I'm glad he came for Red Rocket, a film I really enjoyed, but found a bit challenging to talk about. So it was perfect that Clayton came to help me out. Red Rocket is the latest film from director Sean Baker, who also directed the films Tangerine and The Florida Project. Sean Baker has a bit of a track record now for telling very human, very ethically messy stories about people on the margins of society. That trend continues with Red Rocket, which features Simon Rex as Mikey, an ex-porn star who wants to make up with his estranged wife before he cooks up a scheme to make it big again. We'll fill in some more detail as we discuss the film, so let's get into it. Here's my discussion with Clayton Henderson about the film Red Rocket.
You said you're never going to step a foot in Texas again.
I know, this is unexpected.
Oh, nothing with you is unexpected.
Your last job is over 17 years ago. That's quite a gap.
Well, you know, I've worked almost every day for the last 17 years. I moved back in with my wife last week.
No, I'm calling the cops. 9,
really?
8.
We decided to make a run of it.
I just need a place to crash for a couple of days. What's the big deal?
Mikey, go for yourself.
All right, look, I'm going to be straight with you. I'm an adult film actor.
Excuse me?
So why are you back, Mr. Hollywood?
You're Mikey. Welcome back, dude.
I'm on top of my game right now on, like, every single possible level. Physical stamina. My mind is sharp. I'm taking 5-HTP for serotonin in my brain.
Yeah?
Dude, with my skill and ability, there's no denying what I can do. The universe is on my side, bro.
Before long, it'll be like we're still married.
We are still married.
I'm doing this tonight, probably gonna start a fire.
What's your name?
Everybody calls me Strawberry.
You're like a extraterrestrial around here.
Hello, Clayton Henderson. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
How are you doing today?
Doing good. How are you?
I'm doing very well. I'm so glad to have you on the show. I guess we met over Instagram. Yeah. One thing I do every year with film festivals around Arkansas is I try to connect with filmmakers, and you directed a short that won Filmland this past year called One of These Days. Mm-hmm. And that was my first familiarity with you. So tell us about that film and kind of what the latest is with it. And then I'll ask you too about what's on the horizon.
All right. One of These Days is just a simple little post-apocalyptic dystopian short about a man just trying to find his new home while reflecting on his old home. And that's about as simple as it is, really.
Yeah, it's what struck me about it is just how beautifully shot everything is. Did you shoot that in Arkansas mostly?
Yeah, we shot that all in Arkansas in Smackover, El Dorado, Camden. Yeah.
Mm. Okay. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of just like landscape shots, but then shots of, you know, what looks like ghost town kind of stuff.
And yeah.
This guy walking around.
That was in Chittister, which is close in Camden. That's a really cool spot.
Yeah, great use of like real locations.
And, yeah, it just looked like something happens there. So,
yeah, for sure. Well, yeah, I really enjoyed seeing that, and they played it at the big screen at Filmland out in the park this year, which was really cool. Yeah. What's coming up on the horizon? You have I think I saw on Instagram a new film coming soon.
Yeah, it's a new short called The Blue Dress. It's very different from One of These Days, but it's basically just two people meeting and talking throughout the whole thing. And we're working on getting that made here in the next few months. It's already cast, and we're looking at some nice locations for it. And yeah, just if anyone wants to like keep up with it, you can just follow the Instagram page.
Yeah. I will share the link out for that. And then I was going to ask too, is One of These Days, is that available online to see, or is that it's doing a couple more festivals?
It's still doing its festival run. We're waiting to hear back from a few. And after that, I'll probably put it online sometime once completed with The Blue Dress, probably. That's kind of the idea.
Cool. Well, I'll try to stay up on all the news with that new film coming up and post things as I can. I'm excited. Yeah, so like I'd seen your name on a couple of things. I'm excited that you reached out and decided to do the podcast. We had a couple other ideas of what we might talk about, but then you mentioned you were a big fan of today's film that we're going to discuss, which is Red Rocket, the new Sean Baker film. Oh, yeah. And so that's perfect because it's something I've seen, but it was difficult to formulate thoughts about it. And so I'm excited you said you have a lot of thoughts about it. So without further ado, let's get into Red Rocket.
Okay.
So Clayton, how many of Sean Baker's other films have you seen? And what do you think of him generally as a director?
I saw Tangerine a few years ago. I haven't seen it. I've only seen it once. And I haven't seen his first two. I've seen Tangerine and The Florida Project. Florida Project is one I really, really loved. Except for the last 2 minutes, but I think
that's a
complaint, but I don't hate it. I just love everything else before it. And Tangerine, I just was really impressed by the way he did that all on the
iPhone. Yeah, it's on iPhones, right?
Yeah,
wow.
Phones and having been on set with doing like shooting a film on iPhones, it's a very interesting process. So I don't think it's the new way of cinema, but like just watching what some filmmakers can do with it is really impressive. So
yeah, I don't know. I've seen like Steven Soderbergh has done some iPhone films and things like that. I have actually not seen Tangerine, but it's been on my list forever. And I remember when that came out and it was like, oh, he did this on iPhone. That was like in the news and everything. But then I have seen The Florida Project and I really love that one as well. Willem Dafoe is so amazing in that. And the child performances are so good too. Yeah,
I think that's a great film. Yeah, that's something I really like about Baker is kind of like early David Gordon Green stuff, how everyone in the cast just feels like they're just locals and everything, you don't know what's scripted and what's like improvised or if anything's improvised, but I like the balance between both of like how people talk in his movies. It's just, it's very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's I think some of it must be locals. And, you know, when you were just talking about that, it reminded me of a very different film. But Nomadland, I think Chloe Zhao does a somewhat similar thing.
Yeah, I think.
Using, like, real location. Super different tone and everything. But another filmmaker who's does something somewhat like that. But
yeah. Anyway. I think a lot more, like, indie filmmakers kind of do that approach with just locals to make it more natural. It works for a film like Florida Project and Nomadland, but yeah, it's interesting to me.
Yeah, and I think there's some of that in this film too, in Red Rocket, which we can talk about. I'm curious, compared to his other films, where is Red Rocket for you? Would you say it's your favorite of his, or do you think it's his best? All right. Yeah.
I loved it.
Yeah. I really liked it a lot as well. I think it's definitely his funniest. I was laughing so hard at the running scene at the end in particular. Like, I don't know when I've laughed so hard. That was so hilarious.
The last 20 minutes is some of the most satisfying stuff I've seen in a long time.
And it's like tragic, but also hilariously funny.
Yeah, it's kind of like Episode Gems.
I think it reminds me of that film for sure, in that it's someone in the center of it who's very charismatic and very likable, and they're making a lot of horrible decisions. Mm-hmm. And you're just like waiting for the hammer to drop. And when it finally does, it's, I think, in Uncut Gems, it's, not to spoil that film, but it's really sudden and like it is satisfying in its own way. But in I think in Red Rocket, it might be even better because it is so funny, and it's the way it all plays out is really good, I think.
And tense. Like, it was very tense in the last 20 minutes. Like, as soon as it cuts to black, you're just like, I can breathe. Like, it's just...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, let's talk about Simon Rex, who is that central character, Mikey, who, I guess we should tell a brief plot for people who haven't seen it, but Mikey is a porn star who's kind of down on his luck, can't get work, and seems to be in some kind of trouble, and so he comes back to his hometown in Texas, which is, I can't remember the name of the town, but it's a very
Texas
small.
Texas City, Texas,
yes, yes. Yeah. And his estranged wife lives there with her mother, and he basically, he shows up, that's a big scene when he shows up for the first time at the beginning, and she's like, doesn't want to have anything to do with him, but he kind of talks his way into it, and we begin to see he's such a charmer, such a talker, and can like weasel his way into things, ends up making up with her to some degree, and things are going pretty well. He starts selling drugs to make ends meet, selling weed. And then when the plot really kicks in is when he meets a young woman named Strawberry. That's her nickname anyway. And she is very young. She's 17 years old, and he becomes really infatuated with her, which, as you can tell, is a very problematic thing. And that's kind of baked into the story, is how, I mean, it's very uncomfortable. And so, like with Uncut Gems, I think he makes a lot of unwise decisions. Mm-hmm. In this film, he's doing like absolutely like unethical, horrible things. So I think it's different on that level as well. But essentially, he wants to groom her to become a porn star, and like she'll be his ticket back in. And that's what's going on. And he's like lying to everyone to try to make this all happen. And so that's the story. So Simon Rex, who I didn't know much about, he looked familiar. And then actually A24 put out a video about like his history. He was a VJ on MTV and like has an interesting career.
Was a porn star.
But he was he really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he did like, I was reading, he did like solo stuff under the alias Sebastian.
So. Wow. Well, then he's perfect for this role. I wondered, I could tell IMDb. Like there was...
His two solo stuff are on IMDb. It's...
I click on his IMDb and find those. But so you could tell some of it felt true to life in that he was, you know, maybe he was just an actor down on his luck, but I didn't know he was actually an adult film actor, just like Mikey. That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think of his performance in this?
Oh, it was great.
And
like you said, it feels very close. It feels very personal and passionate. And like I read, like as soon as like he got the script, like 3 days later, he met with Sean and had the whole thing memorized. All the vulgar stuff, all the long lines of dialogue that he does, all memorized, and that's just insane to me with the premise of the movie. But
and he's like in every scene. It's like a lot of dialogue. Yeah.
He's uncomfortable, but like in a humorous way. Like,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
I know I think everyone knows someone just like this character.
Yeah.
Like a constant screw up who's like thinks he's doing good, but everyone's just like, you're not. I think, especially if you like grow up in like small towns, you know someone like that. And all that felt very like, just to me personally, I'm like, I know this guy, but
yeah.
Like, and I felt like he was the character. Like, I didn't see Simon Rex. I saw Mikey. And I think that's the best thing an actor can do, is I forget that they're acting.
So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. He's so magnetic in this and so charming. And it's so believable that he would be able to pull off all the lies that he does, because he is that kind of magnetic as a person. And you get a sense that he really is just that charming in real life too. I think the movie works because of how good he is, because again, it's just so believable, and he kind of holds it all together. And he really anchors it, because I think he is in probably every scene just about.
I think he is, except for a scene right before the start of the climax. I think he's in every scene.
Yeah,
the scene of the wife and mother-in-law outside looking at each other like something bad's about to happen, but
they're setting things up. Well, speaking of the wife and mother-in-law, what did you think of other performers in this film, including them and other people?
They just felt real. And I was looking up who played the wife, and I think she was only in one other thing, and it's just like a patient in Shutter Island. She was one of the
inmates.
And I think that's the only other thing she's ever done. And so like she felt very natural, and like especially near the end, like you can kind of see her character change a little bit, like, okay, you need to leave type, rather than how she was in the middle, kind of like, I'm accepting that you're here and kind of falling back in love with you type thing. The mom was hilarious.
Yeah, it's quite a journey. Yeah, the mom is so funny. Yeah.
The mom is so funny. And like I guarantee that is just a local that Sean just found.
Wow.
Because like that's what he did with the lead actress in Florida Project. He just found her on Instagram. Mm-hmm. So it's just
like, yeah, that's right. I remember hearing that. Yeah.
So like,
yeah, I think the wife, what you're saying, is so good, because her she has quite a character arc, because she's immediately like, get out of here, like cussing him out, go away, and then slowly, gradually starts to have feelings for him again, and then again swings back the other direction, and it's all really believable, and I think she does a great job. The mom character is so funny. I'm trying to find her name.
Yeah, I forgot the mom's name was Lil, I think, but I forgot the actress's name. And the neighbor, he was really fun.
The mom is Lil, is Brenda Dais, I believe, and then his wife is Brie Elrod. Yeah, she's so great.
Yeah,
yeah. The neighbor is so interesting, because, and that's like you're talking about knowing, we all know someone like Mikey. The neighbor is like, they will gravitate to someone who will listen to their BS that they spout all the time, and like that's the character and what ends up happening there, I won't spoil it, but like Lonnie, I think is his name, Ethan Darbone, what ends up happening with his character is very interesting as well, and kind of how that all goes.
The whole time I was watching it, I thought it was that one dude from Avatar. You know, I forget the actor's name, but if you know who I'm talking about, the kind of skinny guy with long hair.
I'm not sure. Well, I'm gonna look and see if Ethan Darbone did anything else.
It's not him. It just looked very.
No, yeah, this is his only credit. Ethan Darbone
is insane in this.
Yeah. Then let's talk about Strawberry. So that's Susanna's son. She actually is not 17. She's like 26.
I should look that up afterwards. So
I looked at this young woman. And so for me, like, I think she's good. I don't think she's great. I think Mikey is the best by far.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And like, so that's one of my things. Like, I do think Florida Project is, I like it better. I think those naturalistic performances are just a little better in Florida Project. Whereas like with Lonnie, the neighbor, like there's sometimes you can tell like he's not necessarily used to being on camera, like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's not horrible, but it's like Mikey is, Simon Rex is like very much the MVP, I think, as far as the actors go. Yeah.
I think a lot of like the Psy performances come out from Simon Rex, as like he kind of makes them feel comfortable on screen. And you know, like when they first start talking, you're like, oh, they're not that good. But as later, as it goes along, you're like, oh, you're feeling more comfortable, and it feels more, it feels, and if in a way it feels more natural, because like, oh, here's this guy I haven't seen in 25 years. How do I act around whenever just suddenly he appears?
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess that makes sense in that way. Like they're a little more standoffish at first, but then kind of gradually become closer. And yeah, I think that's what works well with Strawberry's character, is like the meet cute, I guess, and like the flirting and how that kind of builds, I think works well. Yeah, I think there are some moments where her acting doesn't totally shine, but I think overall she's really good. She looks like she's that young, and looks like she explains. Yeah, she really does. I was like, she could be like 15.
Yeah.
I almost thought, is going to come out that she's lying about her age or something.
I thought so too. Because like, they lie about her being 18, but
yeah, because she's like 3 weeks away from turning 18 or something like that, I think.
It was just so funny watching that, because I'm 19, and just especially coming out of like high school like a year ago, I know so many people like that.
Yeah.
And like small town people like that, where gossip gets around, and it's just like, yeah, some students are like that, and just how the way Baker captured that, I'm just like, that's spot on. The same with just like white trash America. He's just spot on with all that. It's kind of like a more tasteful Harmony Korine in a way, like a more tasteful kids, if that makes sense.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. I like what Sean Baker does. Like, so because I haven't seen Tangerine, but what I know about it, like, he seems like he goes into these kind of into the margins and finds these stories that we don't think about, we don't like to think about in like respectable society or whatever.
And
he finds the humanity there and like, and tells that story. And I heard him in an interview once, I think, talking about Tangerine, or maybe it was with Florida Project, but just like he finds these stories. Like with Florida Project, there are people that live like that in these little motels, and they're right next to this, all this wonderfully rich capitalism, and like the disparity of that is so interesting and compelling.
In El Dorado, a town close by, there's a hotel that is just like that. So it's real. It's a thing. Just no one likes to think about it. But
And I think it's important. I think his films feel important in that way. And I think with Red Rocket, I felt a little less that way, but I think it is amazing that, you know, this is a really yucky situation, and he's finding the humanity in it and making us care about the people involved. Not offering any solutions, like, how do we fix this kind of thing from happening? Like, that's not what he's interested in doing. He's just saying, look at this, and like,
it's gonna happen.
These are humans just like you. And
I think that's powerful. I kind of like that idea of like Hollywood coming over to white trash America. Because like he's talking about like his Lamborghinis and his Mr. Hollywood lifestyle to these people who have no idea what the hell he's talking about, and it's just that there's some humor in that, and there's probably some deeper meaning in that as well. But
Well, any other high points or low points of this film that you wanted to mention?
I don't know if it's a low point, but just making the audience uncomfortable with Simon Rex and the teenage girl, Suzanne Sun, I think that's her name.
Yes, Suzanne Sun, yeah.
I think it was supposed to make you uncomfortable, but it was also very humorous in a way, because it wasn't being romanticized. And I think that kind of works with it, with something like also this year, Licorice Pizza, which also got the same type of controversy. But just like in that, in Red Rocket, they address that this is kind of wrong. it's not like fully romanticized until kind of the end, but it makes sense in that movie. And this, it's just like, this is happening, and this probably does happen a lot more than we think.
I was just about to bring Licorice Pizza up. I actually just saw it yesterday, and I'm still kind of wrestling with that part of it, because I thought it was very good. I think exactly what you're saying, like in Red Rocket, it's like, we know this is a really yucky situation. Like, we know this is unethical, and like what he's doing is despicable. But it's like fascinating to see how it unfolds. I actually haven't seen that, but I know enough about
it. Oh, it's crazy.
That's been on my list forever too. With Licorice Pizza, it doesn't address it in that way, and it feels like it wants you to celebrate this, and I'm sure it's also wanting you to kind of ask that question of yourself. But it is I think too, the genders are swapped. So like, here we mm-hmm. have a young woman and an older man, Licorice Pizza, an older woman and a younger man. And so what I was thinking last night, as I was thinking about Licorice Pizza, was like, okay, why was I more okay with the man being younger than I was with the woman?
Yeah.
And so like, that's another thing. Like, it just naturally was more repulsed in mm-hmm. Red Rocket. And also it's like much more sexual in Red Rocket and that sort of thing too. Yeah. So there's that aspect of it, but. Yeah, that's interesting. I think it kind of plays with gender. If you think about those two,
the bedroom scene. Yikes.
Yeah.
The filming scene.
Yes. Yeah, that's probably the worst of that kind of thing.
Did you see it with a crowd?
I didn't. I watched. I had a screener. I watched it at home by myself.
I watched it with a crowd, and when I was going in, I did not know what to expect. Like, I thought I was going to be the only one in there for a while. Then other people came in. I was like, they're either going to laugh their ass off or this is going to be the most quiet theater ever. And they were awkward. It was.
Oh, nice.
They were just like the whole time. It's just like, you just keep yelling at this character. Just like, what the hell are you doing? You need to stop. it was very fun with the crowd. Surprisingly.
Yeah, I bet that was something I was like, oh man, I wish I could have seen this with the crowd. Another thing I don't want to spoil, well, I already mentioned it, but like that really funny running scene at the end. I bet this would be hilarious with a whole crowd. I was by myself on my couch laughing my ass off. It was so funny. But
it's funny how, like, we're jumping all over the place with it, but it's fun just like how after the As Played at Cannes logo disappears and Bye 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 starts playing.
Yes. And that's so funny too, because Bye 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 has that like weird like electronic string intro like right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I was like, why do I know this? What is this familiar for? And then it's Bye Bye Bye. Like, oh my gosh, this is amazing.
This is what Scorsese calls cinema. It's just
yes. And just so good.
I liked your cover of the song as well.
I was going to mention just like that use of that song and the music in general. Mm-hmm. Like it comes up, I guess, three times when she sings it the once. And that's an interesting thing too. I think that there's a moment that's like, it's right in the middle of like the hardest to watch scenes, like in her bedroom. Like we're like, we don't need to be here. And yet we see like she has this creativity and this artistic side, and like we see the beauty of these humans despite the terrible mm-hmm. thing they're involved in. And that's just a really interesting experience.
Yeah, music and all these uncomfortable high point scenes, the introduction, the bedroom scene, mm-hmm. the climax, then just like as soon as it's over, it's dead silent in the credits. like a Hanukkah film. It's just dead silent. And you're just like, what do I do now? It's just
like it has that final shot, which it's not really a spoiler to say, but like it ends kind of ambiguously, I guess. And then it cuts to black and I was like, what am I supposed to do with this ending? And I'm still kind of figuring that out. But
you know how in the Florida Project, it kind of has that fairy tale like ending where they're running mm-hmm. off to the Magic Kingdom? Spoilers. Yeah. But this is kind of like the anti fairy tale ending. It's rare that a comedy will be on my best of the year list, but it's up there. It's definitely, I don't think top five, but as of now, top 10 for sure. So
nice. I did my list a few weeks ago and it did not make it, but it would have been probably top 20, I would say.
Yeah. I usually try to do a top 20 list that I just share online, but there's still a lot more films that I'm trying to check out before I release anything. Yeah. I try to do that. I usually wait till like the Oscars come out, then I post my favorite ones.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm curious to see what ends up being nominated in that realm. I doubt this film will be in the conversation, but you never know.
Well, Defoe was nominated.
Simon Rex is really good.
Defoe was
nominated. Oh, he was, wasn't he?
Roderick, that's so right. Simon Rex, I can see him getting nominated. It's just a lot.
That'd be wild. but it'd be cool.
It's also like one of those movies that's like, oh, this is going to bring his career back type thing. Mm-hmm. Like we made this for him. This is his comeback movie. Like like how Tarantino does with older actors, and he brings them back and then suddenly they're in everything else. So like, I can kind of see that happening with him.
Yeah, I'll keep an eye out for Simon Rex in the future.
Yeah. He made a movie in Shreveport, so.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Nice. Did you watch Zola earlier this year?
I did watch Zola. This reminded me a lot of Zola.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up earlier just because when I first saw the trailer for Red Rocket, I was like, that looks a lot like Zola. And then it was less like Zola than I thought, but I think similar energy as far as like
white trash,
chaotic, trashy comedy kind of thing, but with an art house sensibility in a way that's like it's got some deeper themes and some deeper meaning that's there for you.
Both A24 films.
Yeah, and both A24. It's kind of their bread and butter is these fun but deeper movies, I think. Anyway.
They've made some of the best films this year.
Yeah, I think so too. I already talked about Come On on the podcast a few weeks ago, but that was them as well, and loved that. That ended up being my number one of the year, actually.
Really Green Knight is my number one. I've seen that.
Green Knight. Yes, that's also A24. That was on my top 10. I can't remember. I think three or four. That Anywho. One
and Lamb. Those are my two favorite from this year.
Lamb is very good also. A24 had a good year. Those are all very good movies, and those are all A24 movies. That's one I would love to watch again. It's almost like puts you in a trance a little bit with the way it's shot and like the atmosphere of it. But
it was kind of mismarketed, I think. It was kind of marketed as a horror movie. Yeah. And it's but it's more shocking at first, but then it's like, yeah, okay, this is kind of beautiful.
Yeah, and like the lamb itself, the Ada character
she's adorable, is
like breathtaking, and you can't take your eyes off her. And like I was gonna say the effects of that are incredible.
I cannot tell if that's practical or not. I need to read up on that.
Well, any other thoughts on Red Rocket before we wrap up?
In terms of a rating, it's a solid 9 for me. It's
solid 9. Let me see what I put on Letterboxd because I can't remember, but I will find out really quick and tell you my rating. It's 9s not as high as that, but
yeah, it's rare that I give 9s, and it's rare that I give 10s. So Sean Baker should feel proud.
I gave it 3.5 out of 5. So good, not great, but I did really like it. And actually, the more I talk about it, the more I'm like, maybe I didn't give this enough credit. So I think on a rewatch, might end up being higher. Yeah. Yes. And I am curious to see, like, as award season gets into gear, if it has more attention either for him or for the film as a whole, because I think it is one of the strongest films of the year.
The editing was really good. I really liked the editing, and I should have known this before. I just found out he edits his movies.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I just found that out. I was like, okay, that makes sense. That's captures his like aesthetic, his very colorful trash. And
then that reminds me of The Green Knight again with David Lowery, because I think he started out as an editor, and like I think he probably still edits his films too.
The indie ones. No, I don't think he does the Disney ones, but
right. Yeah, but like Ghost Story, I know he did, and I bet he did with Green Knight too. Ghost Story's great. You a fan of that one?
Oh, I love David Lowery. I saw Ghost Story at a screening at Filmland, and David Lowery was there.
I was there as well. Yeah, that was a great screening.
That was awesome.
Yeah.
That was the first film I saw from him, and he's been one of my favorites since. So
he's a really great filmmaker.
Oh my gosh, I love him.
Well, that will do it for the Red Rocket Talk. Thank you so much for joining the show today, Clayton. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah, I've never done a podcast before.
Well, now you have. You did great, and we can. I'll have to have you back again sometime.
Yeah, I love talking movies.
Huge thanks once again to Clayton. I loved hearing his thoughts on that one. And now it's time for my favorite segment, What Have You Been Watching Lately?, in which I run through some of my other stuff that I've been watching and give my brief reactions. First up, I watched Nightmare Alley, the newest film from Guillermo del Toro, and starring Bradley Cooper, Rooney Mara, and Cate Blanchett. I'm a big fan of this one. I don't think I like it quite as much as his previous film, The Shape of Water, But Nightmare Alley follows Bradley Cooper's character Stanton Carlyle as he first joins the circus and then later takes his mind-reading act on the road. He's very good at convincing people he's a medium, and we watch him push his deception further and further until he's mixed up in some very shady business. The film has a kind of slick noir feel to it, and all of the actors are incredible, including the smaller roles from Toni Collette, Willem Dafoe, Richard Jenkins, and Ron Perlman. It's ultimately a film about ego and also has some thematic ties around the seven deadly sins, and I liked it quite a bit. Nightmare Alley is now playing in theaters, and I gave it 4 out of 5 stars. Also, over the holiday break, like a lot of people, I saw Spider-Man No Way Home. This one really pushes all the nerd buttons in a good way, and I had a great time with it. I know some critics are knocking it for being so full of fan service, but I really felt like those elements served the greater story of Peter's journey. Seeing this on opening night was also one of the most thrilling theater experiences I've had in a while. It was just before the Omicron spike started, so I felt pretty safe being in a crowded room, and the energetic reactions to certain surprises in this film were very exciting. Spider-Man No Way Home is in theaters, and I gave it 4 stars. I also finally saw West Side Story, and this film completely blew me away. Steven Spielberg is obviously a genius, and it's so thrilling to watch one of the masters of cinema put his full creative force into a project like this. From the opening scene, everything in this film works so well. It's visually just treat after treat. The music is obviously amazing, and I like almost all of the performances. The standouts are Ariana DeBose as Anita and David Alvarez as Bernardo, but there's really not a bad performance in the entire film. I am a bit mixed on Ansel Elgort as Tony. I've never been a huge fan of his, but I think he does a solid job here. His singing is surprisingly good, and his chemistry with Rachel Zegler as Maria is great. I don't think he totally holds the screen in like solo dance scenes, but all in all, pleasantly surprised by him. I'd say he's good with flashes of greatness, where basically everyone else in the film is exceptional. And did I mention Rita Moreno? So, so good. 5 stars for West Side Story, 5 out of 5, and it is in theaters now. Over the break, I also rewatched The Matrix, and then watched The Matrix Reloaded and The Matrix Revolutions for the first time. I know the sequels are generally not thought of very highly, but I actually really enjoyed them. That's all I'll say for now, because I believe I'm going to do a Matrix episode in a few weeks, including a discussion of the new Matrix Resurrections, which is now in theaters. The first 3 Matrix films are now streaming on HBO Max. And I also caught up with Licorice Pizza, the new film from Paul Thomas Anderson. This really wasn't what I was expecting, but I do think it's very good. It's quite unfocused narratively. The film sort of drifts from plot point to plot point in its lazy 1970s setting without much connective tissue or overarching purpose. I can almost compare it to a film like Dazed and Confused, but it is a bit more cohesive than that. And that isn't a criticism. I really like Dazed and Confused, and I really enjoyed Licorice Pizza. I was just caught off guard by it. The story follows a 15-year-old who loves to cook up schemes named Gary, played by Cooper Hoffman, who is the son of the late Philip Seymour Hoffman. Gary starts business after business, always charming people and trying to make a buck. He is also infatuated with a woman named Alana, played magnificently by Alana Haim. There are a ton of side characters who pop up in random little vignettes that make up this movie. And this film really is all over the place, but it's very pleasant to just live in its world for a couple of hours and take it all in. I'd say the film is strongest when it's funny. It has laughs throughout, but there are a few sequences that are outright comedic, and those really made the movie for me. Licorice Pizza gets 4 out of 5 stars for me, and it is now playing in theaters. And finally, a couple of TV things. My wife and I usually have a serious show and a funny show going all the time, and we just finished our funny show that we've been working on for quite a while, and it's Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I watched a lot of Brooklyn Nine-Nine while it was on the air, but we started from the beginning a few months ago and have watched it all the way through. If you're unfamiliar, this is a sitcom starring Andy Samberg and Andre Brower about a police precinct in New York and the goofy things they get up to. Notably, the final season was delayed after the murder of George Floyd, and the writers rewrote the final episodes to address that. I was really curious to see how that would go, and I thought it was pretty good. One of the main characters, Rosa Diaz, immediately quits the force to become a PI and try to help victims of police brutality. And characters on the show end up fighting against the police union to try to push for reform. It's a pretty remarkable show for the way it is, you know, this silly comedy, but it's always been just grounded enough to comment on real-world issues, and I think the final season was really strong. Brooklyn Nine-Nine is streaming on Peacock and Hulu. So that was our funny show, and our serious show was Succession. We had some friends strongly recommending this one, and we ended up binging all three seasons pretty quickly, and it's very good. Here's the weird description I gave this show to a friend the other day. Succession is kind of like a mixture of Arrested Development and Game of Thrones. I know that sounds weird, and really it's not that much like either of those shows. It's definitely not over-the-top silly like Arrested Development, but it is about a family-owned company and how messy it gets when your siblings and parents are also your coworkers. And the Game of Thrones comparison is basically because most of the characters on the show are vying for power within the company. There's a lot of very interesting family dynamics, very strong writing, a lot of surprising moments, and it's also quite funny. Nicholas Braun plays maybe the funniest character, and he's great every time he's on screen. So I'll highly recommend Succession, and that is now streaming on HBO Max. Season 3 just ended a few weeks ago. And that is what I've been watching. So now let's move on to our second discussion, continuing our series on religious deconstruction. I call it The Art of Deconstruction, Faith, Doubt, and Film. And so far, we've looked at some really wonderful films, including Ingmar Bergman's Winter Light, Martin Scorsese's Silence, and Lars von Trier's Breaking the Waves. Today, we've got another great one. It's Denis Villeneuve's 2016 film, Arrival. My guest today is Bethany Worden. I met Bethany online in a virtual film club and quickly grew to appreciate her views on cinema. So I was thrilled when she said yes to appearing on the show. Bethany works in artist support and public programming for a company called Define American, which is an organization focused on art and culture as it pertains to immigration and citizenship. She oversees a fellowship for artists who are immigrants. So a really cool job. I've put a link to Bethany's Instagram in the show notes if you want to give her a follow. Bethany is going to tell us her story and then get into Arrival and why it's such a meaningful film to her. If you haven't seen Arrival, I encourage you to keep listening now to hear about Bethany. We do get into spoilers later, but we will give a spoiler warning so you can tune out at that point. And with that, here is my conversation with Bethany Worden about Denis Villeneuve's Arrival.
There are days that define your story beyond your life. Like the day they arrived.
Signs of what might be called first contact. The objects measure at least...
I'm Colonel G.T. Weber from Army Intelligence.
Pack your bags. You're at the top of everyone's list when it comes to translations.
Priority one. What do they want? Where are they from? You'll be reporting to me, but you'll be working with him when you're in the show.
That's what they call him, the UFO.
Who's being carted off in the medevac?
Not everyone is wired for what you're about to do.
So what do they look like?
You'll see soon enough.
Every 18 hours, a door opens up. That's where we go in.
Welcome to the podcast, Bethany Worden. How are you today?
I'm good. It's so fun to be here.
Yeah, I'm so excited to have you. You know, we've met through, as many of my previous guests in this series, through this philosophy group that looks at different films every week. And it's been great to meet people like you who have things in common with me and to talk about a lot of really good movies. But yeah, listening to you in those discussions, you were someone who was like, I would love to hear her in a more one-on-one situation. So glad that's finally happening. But yeah, have you been well, generally speaking?
I have been well. I'm in Los Angeles, so we've been dealing with very high COVID numbers right now. Mm-hmm. But thankfully, I can work from home and Yes. Also, thankfully, we have good weather, so we can be outside and do hikes and stuff like that, even if can't do yes. so many indoor things right now.
That is good. That's generally true here in Arkansas, too, that it's pretty cold actually now, but it still gets warm enough that you can go outside. But yeah, our vaccination rates are very low, unfortunately, and so our COVID rate is currently very high. So it's climbing again, and it definitely feels like we're going back in time. Anyway. Mm. Let's talk about you and the film you selected today. But so what I've been doing for this series, which we're calling The Art of Deconstruction, is first asking you about your faith as much as you feel comfortable talking about, and then a film that is pertinent to your faith. So that first question is, tell us about your faith in as much detail as you are comfortable with, and how it has changed over the years.
Yeah, I'd listened to the previous ones in the series. As sort of like a preparation for this question, because there are many different directions I could go with this. I think something that's interesting, the first church that I remember attending was an evangelical Methodist church. And Methodists are, their big thing is John Wesley's teaching about the heart, and that sort of the way that we hear the Holy Spirit is through the warming of the heart. Which is something that I've sort of been able to hold on to through my whole journey through faith.
That's cool.
Yeah, my parents, my dad's family is Catholic. My mom's family grew up in a Presbyterian church. So from a pretty young age, I was aware of sort of the spectrum of faith traditions, even within Christianity. And then I grew up mostly outside the U.S.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, in countries that were not predominantly Christian. So I grew up with Buddhist friends and Muslim friends, and of course also secular atheist and agnostic friends. But I think that, you know, even in the midst of all that, there was a strong pressure for like the right way of belief and the right way of thinking. And, you know, a lot of fear around doing things wrong or being sinful, or, you know, lots of confession and repentance and, you know, being told that your sort of first inclinations are wicked as opposed to good. And there was a lot of heaviness and pressure for the way that I felt like I was supposed to be. And I carried that pretty well, I have to say. Like, I followed the rules. Like, I'm very much a rule follower. I did the things. But then there, like, came to be a point in my college years and, like, shortly after where that heaviness just, I think I became aware of it and aware that not everyone else was living that way. And wanted to, you know, find some other ways of living. And I started that kind of timidly, attending different kinds of churches, reading books by different kinds of theologians, exploring maybe more mystical practices that are part of like ancient Christianity as opposed to sort of contemporary evangelicalism. But it took me a really long time to identify that my faith was largely oriented around if-then statements, like if you are a good person, good things will happen to you. Grew up in purity culture. If you are, you know, a virgin when you get married, you'll have a great marriage and great sex life and all of that. And it took me a very long time to recognize that even as I was trying to expand my faith and my faith definitions, that I was still operating in that sort of if-then world. And that completely fell apart when I went through a really traumatic divorce. And it forced me to confront those questions in a very personal way. It forced me to answer other people's questions in a very personal way. And that also gave me a lot of freedom, to be honest, like having failed and failed that publicly. It gives you a lot of freedom to try things a different way and try living a different way, try thinking a different way, try loving a different way. And that's sort of where I am now. I still identify as a Christian in a very like broad sense. I don't identify as evangelical. I attend lots of different kinds of churches. Sometimes I don't go to church. Still sort of landing on a definition, but also very comfortable in the space of questioning and exploring and letting that be part of my faith.
Yeah, that's great. And that's, yeah, that's so interesting too, is like feeling comfortable in a place that, you know, if 10 years ago me could see what I'm doing now, they would be appalled, you know? But I like too what you said about sort of the core of, I guess, Methodism. I was not raised Methodist, so that I know a little bit about it, but like having something that you do still hold on to as a through line through all of that, that's really cool. Because I think part of the challenge when you start saying, okay, all these things I believe, I think some of these I need to shed. What do I hold on to? And like some of those things seem stuck together, and that's such a long and arduous process and lifelong process too. But yeah. And then too, about, just like going through hard things tends to, from different stories I've heard, tends to be something that can really shake you from those kinds of deeply held things. I think it's like Richard Rohr who talks about going through suffering is like an important part of that. And, I think that's another through line that I hear often is, I went through something and it kind of caused me to unfasten from those things that I thought were so permanent, you know. So anyway, thanks so much for sharing that. That's very interesting, and I'm really curious to hear about your take on this film today. So I asked you to select a film that you found meaningful on a faith level, and you chose Arrival, Denis Villeneuve's film. And you had a few other options, but this is the one that kind of struck out to me, just because it's one I'd seen before and I had not thought about it at all in this way. So first of all, tell us a little bit, kind of the basics about Arrival for people who haven't seen it or don't know anything about it. Who directed it? I already said that, but who's in it? Kind of what it's about.
Yeah, so it's a Denis Villeneuve film. I think it might have been the first Denis Villeneuve film that I saw personally. I have since gone back to watch all of them.
Same for me, yeah.
And it stars Amy Adams and Jeremy Renner primarily. And the story is ships, or I guess I should say unidentified flying objects appear in 12 different locations around the world. And Amy Adams is a linguist and translator, and Jeremy Renner is a scientist and physicist. And they're both invited to the site of one of these UFOs to try and communicate with the beings inside the UFO and figure out where they came from and why they're here and what they plan to do and if they're peaceful or, you know, if they're warlike. And the story follows that sort of untangling of trying to figure out those things with, beings that don't speak a human language, don't communicate in a human way, don't use human math or language practices at all. How do you, it's the ultimate like cross-cultural experience. How do you share something with someone that you have no common ground with?
That's such an interesting way to put it, because I spent some time, if you've listened to these previous podcasts, I've spent some time living in China and sometimes just like abroad in college in the UK. Those cross-cultural things are so interesting. And I was actually an English major, so like the language side of this was so interesting to me too. So I was glad to watch this again, because I remembered the first time, it was only my second time watching it. I think the first time I saw it, I was so caught up in like the science fiction-y, like brain teasery stuff, that I didn't really key into the emotional side of it quite as much. But this time I did, and I liked it a lot more. I remember liking it the first time, but this time it really connected with me. It's probably my favorite of his films actually that I've seen. I haven't seen all of them, but thank you for sparking that rewatch, because I really, really connected with it this time around. As I mentioned, like I was surprised at this choice, because in previous films in this series, we talked about Silence and Winter Light and Breaking the Waves, all things that are kind of overtly about religion, organized religion, even loss of faith. And this is not overtly any of those things. So I have no idea what you're going to say. I guess like I hadn't had an idea for those previous films. But so that third question is, I do believe that cinema is spiritual. What about this film connects with you spiritually?
Yeah, that's really interesting that it wasn't an emotional watch for you the first time. Because I think this one very much is an emotional watch for me from the first time I saw it in a theater. I feel like I have to preface, just because I do like film programming and like film program curation, that like this is not a perfect film. Like it's not like even in like my top 10 list of like great films. But it is for me a very emotionally resonant film. And I feel like it does go to that like spiritual, mystical place that art can go, where it connects with something that I didn't have language for, I didn't have pictures for, I didn't have words for. So the first time that I saw this film was in the theater. It was about 2 years after my divorce, and I was still like struggling with a lot of questions around that experience and not really understanding why it happened. It was a very sudden situation for me, and I didn't get a lot of answers really as to why it happened. And I am someone that wants a reason and an answer for everything. And during that period, I'd kind of developed this habit of I'm really lucky. There's an art house theater walking distance from my house. I developed this habit of weekly or every other week stopping there on my way home from work and just watching whatever was playing. That became like a very almost religious experience for me. I'd usually go on a weeknight, so there's hardly anyone there. I'd go by myself. I'd often, this theater like has tea on the menu, so I'd often get like a cup of tea and just like sit in the theater, and like I wouldn't necessarily like know what the film, much about the film, like before I went in, like just kind of like look at the list of what's playing and like choose something, and then just let it be an experience, like really turn off the sort of analytical film criticism part of my brain and just like allow it to be an experience. And I really enjoyed that. I've greatly missed not going to theaters during these last 2 years. Anyway, so this was one of those ones, like I didn't really know that much about it going in. Like I'd seen Amy Adams on the poster and like, you know, knew that it was about something like unusual, but that's about all that I knew going in. I just sat down and like went for the ride, and very quickly like resonated with something in the imagery, in the sound design. Like I love the soundtrack in that film. It's very atmospheric and like both comforting and unsettling at the first time. It's very big sounding to me, especially like being able to hear it in a theater setting. And it just felt safe to just like let myself like go with it and just let myself like go with Amy Adams' journey as a linguist through this mystery, essentially, that she's trying to unravel. And you know, as the story progresses, like you see the questions and how important they are. Like these are really life or death questions. Essentially, the military, the US military, is asking them to determine like whether they need to start war against these UFOs or whether, you know, they can just get knowledge from them and let them go, or what to do. And, you know, Amy Adams is a linguist. Like she's not a military tactics specialist or anything, and so she's in this very uncomfortable position, but she knows her work. She knows what to do to try and communicate with someone that you don't know how to communicate with, and she knows how to ask the questions that she needs to ask to get there. And at some point she sort of like stops being afraid of that mission and just like really like living her passion. And that's really fun to watch. Like, I always think it's really fun to watch someone do something they really love. I love it when people really like their jobs, no matter what it is, and you get to, like, see them do it. It's always so fascinating to me, just that cool. The way that passion drives someone.
Even at the moment where she, like, takes the hazmat suit off and it's like, screw all this, like, formality. Like, I need to try to connect here. Yeah, that's a great,
absolutely,
like, physical representation of that.
Yeah, Yeah. Actually, there's that part of it that's like this unveiling. And also, I was noticing this time, first of all, when they get to the ship for the first time, it's dawn. Like, the sun is just coming up. The light is just coming up. And I thought that was really interesting because I feel like a lot of UFO movies, the first time you see the UFO, it's in the dark. And often there's, like, the lights are shining from the UFO. Yeah. But it's, like, you know, off in the distance or whatever. But they're, like, coming up to it and they can fully see it and the light is on it. And then when they actually go inside the ship, they go through this, like, very dark tunnel cave-like experience up towards the area where the aliens, I guess. I don't know what to call them. The beings. They even call them aliens. are in the ship, and in that area is light. And it was like really this time bringing up imagery of like Plato's cave, but sort of like reverse. Like they had to sort of like leave the real world to see the light. Anyway, I just feel like there's a lot.
Think about that, yeah.
There's a lot there around like unveiling and not being afraid of this situation and being like very open with it, transparent with it, that I really appreciated. And so then, you know, as the story goes on, she comes to realize that the way that they communicate through writing is through these circular looking forms that have no beginning and no end.
This might be a good place to say spoiler warning if you haven't seen it. Just I mean, what we've said so far is not really a spoiler, but I think maybe you're about to get there. So I hope you've listened up to this point, regardless of whether you've seen it. But if you don't want to be spoiled, tune out now. All right, go ahead.
Yes. So as they're uncovering the way that their writing is circular, that there's no beginning and no end, and they are figuring out how to decode them and how to write them too, Amy Adams starts having these experiences that seem like you're not sure if they're memories or dreams, but they're obviously very impactful and in some ways like disruptive for her. They're alternatingly frightening and comforting, and she doesn't want to talk about them with anyone. You know, really big spoil alert, she comes to understand that their writing has no beginning and no end, because for these aliens, they can understand time outside of a linear model, that they can understand it in sort of a more complete and circular way. So they can understand the past and the present and the future simultaneously. And that comes through in their language. And as Amy Adams learns their language, she comes to understand things that way as well, which is where those memories and dream like experiences come up. And you find out that those are actually things in her future that will soon become part of her lived experience.
I really like how they set that up to I think Jeremy Renner, maybe this is actually in a dream sequence, I'm just realizing, but he says something about some linguistic theory about the language that you learn as a child affects the way you think, and like literally affects your brain. And so then we realize, oh, their language causes them to experience, it's because they experience time in a nonlinear way, that's a gateway for her to essentially be able to see the future. That's such a really unique and cool just sci-fi construction into an alien story. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure, like, you know, your experience learning other languages in other countries, like, that is true. Like, the way that someone phrases something, you know, I don't know Chinese, but my understanding of Chinese is that verb tenses are really different than in English. Like, all of that does change your experience of the world and of describing the world, and you know, not to the extent that like you can see the past or future, unfortunately, right. But you can definitely like interpret the present differently, especially in, you know, trying to share it with someone else.
Yeah, I don't know Chinese either. I learned, you know, this much when I was there, but it is, even just that little bit, you start to understand things about Chinese culture that seems so strange at first, but like, oh, that makes sense. And like, this is how they think and this is how they speak. And yeah. So yeah, I think I love that it takes that idea to like this sci-fi realm. But
yeah. And then, you know, as you're starting to put together all of these, what you thought were maybe memories or dreams through the story, you come to understand that Amy Adams and Jeremy Renner are going to get together and they're going to have a daughter, and their daughter is going to have a rare disease and she's going to die. And Amy Adams like knows all of that before it's going to happen. And the film ends, and the sort of last scene is basically a question of like, do you want to live that? And she decides that she does. And you know, that's such a powerful question. I feel like, you know, sometimes we ask that like playfully or whatever, like if you could know the future, would you want to or whatever? And I've always been someone who said no to that question. I think that's like terrifying. It just feels like so much responsibility to like know what's coming and then have to decide what to do. I think it's hard enough to make decisions like on a moment to moment basis. But I was just really like struck by the power of that, choosing something, because you know it's going to be both beautiful and painful, and in getting to know that in its fullness and still like not regretting it and not choosing something else. And I think, you know, for those of us without alien language way of thinking, I think that that's more like how we look at our pasts. Like, how do we want to categorize our memories? How do we want to rewrite those experiences? We can choose to like categorize them as regret or just focus on the pain, or we can like accept them for the fullness that they are, the beauty and the pain, and sift through that and find a meaning where there might be, and also be okay that some places there's not meaning and it's just an experience. By the end of that film watching experience, I was like weeping. So much so that like one of the ushers came over like, are you okay? I was like, yeah, I'm fine. I just really loved this film. I'll like get up in a minute. But for me, it just, you know, it gave pictures and it gave a story and it gave like some definition around what I was feeling, where like I was really coming to a place where I was comfortable with questions, but I think I was like afraid of how to explain that to other people. And, you know, that I was okay with this like both beauty and pain in my story, but feeling like I needed to like put a bow on it for other people or find some resolution that I could explain. And I like, there was just something about this film watching experience that really relieved a lot of that pressure. There's a Rilke quote that I really love, that this, I feel like, connects with this film. And he says, be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms and like books that are now written in a very foreign tongue. Do not now seek the answers which cannot be given you, because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything, live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer.
Wow, that's beautiful. Yeah, that when I finished the film, I was like, I wonder how Bethany's in it, what direction we'll go with this. And it was, I was kind of close, like thinking about, just painful experiences and appreciating them for what they are. I mean, yeah, looking at the past, like you talk about, whether that's relationship or like looking at my faith life, and like, I can feel so much regret that I feel like, oh, all these years wasted, or like, I can't believe it took me so long to realize certain things. But even amidst that, there was beauty, there was connections I wouldn't have made any other way. I got married when I believed those things, and I love my wife, and like we wouldn't have the relationship we have without those things, without asking those questions together too. So that's a whole separate thing. But then also, I think looking to the future and understanding that all relationships eventually end, whether that's someone dies or like whatever. And I think I had a sense of not to make this about me, but when I was watching, I had a sense about like the people that I know in my immediate circles that, you know, will die eventually. And like how I try not to think about that all the time. Whether that's, like family members, my kids who, who are both disabled and life expectancy is different because of that. And, so those kinds of things are top of mind sometimes. And this really did help me kind of work through some of that in a way that was really cool. So thank you for the rewatch for that reason too. But yeah, I wondered too, if you would get to, another thing I guess I thought of was, you know, the problem of evil is a big thing. And, you know, having faith in God or being an atheist or whatever, that's like a thing that comes up in those conversations. And I think this film speaks to that in an interesting way too, just the way that, you know, like she knows that these bad things are going to happen. And like, and the film doesn't say like, you know, God caused her daughter to die or anything like that. It doesn't go to that place, but my brain went to that place and I was like, where's the meaning in this? And the film kind of answers that, like the scene where she has a conversation with her daughter about, she doesn't tell her what's going to happen, but about why they're divorced essentially. It was so moving how she's explaining, I can't remember exactly the wording of things, but that hard things happen. And, but there's beauty before that essentially. But yes, I thought that was all really, really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's sort of interesting, that talking about God is completely absent in this film. Like, I feel like that often comes up in sort of alien stories because it's, you know, you're talking about the universe, you're talking about, you know, all these really big things. There's one little thing on the
news. There's like cults that are like going crazy because of this happening, but that's like, it's a, just a little aside, but yeah, go on.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's sort of like the only mention of God or religion at all. But at the same time, like it does feel kind of present, just because it is sort of asking these questions sort of about like what makes us human and what makes us good or what makes us bad. And, you know, sort of through the lens of these other creatures that you don't know if they're good or bad or even how like sentient they are. Like, I feel like that's kind of a question that's being explored and, you know, whether we should approach these creatures from somewhere else, like in a peaceful way or in a militaristic way. And, you know, I feel like all of those are like really big religious questions, like how you treat the stranger is sort of like a core question of most religious beliefs. And so I think it's interesting that it's like, for me, it feels very present, but it's not ever explicitly discussed.
Yeah, that's really a really good point. Yeah, speaking about like the connection stuff, just like it visualizes like reaching out and trying to have empathy for strangers, like like you're saying. One thing I thought of this time was when they're in the cave, as you call it earlier, like Plato's the cave, but I can't remember what they call it in the film, but the chamber where they communicate with the aliens, what do they end up calling them? Heptapods or something, because they have seven legs. It struck me this time that it kind of looks like a big movie screen. Like it kind of looks like a cinema, this big wide window. And I thought it's so interesting to choose to have this window that they're communicating through. And then as she's like reaching out to touch, it reminded me of like in Persona, the Bergman film, there's the image of the boy reaching to the screen. And so I just thought about like the power of art and like how that is a connection tool as well. And like one of the things I love about cinema in general, but especially like foreign cinema or classic cinema, that's, you know, the target audience, initial target audience or the creators of that art are so far removed from my experience, like decades ago it was made, or on the other side of the world where the customs are completely different, yet still you can find those connections. And that gets me so excited. And I don't think that registered the first time I saw it. And that was another thing I loved about it this time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think another thing that sort of struck me on this watch was sort of what was going on in the background. You know, this film came out I think it was like September 2016. It's definitely like pre-election 2016. So, you know, before, in the before times. But there was like a lot of imagery that felt like even more present than maybe it did in 2016.
Yeah.
There's like the hazmat suits that they're wearing. And like, I don't think I've ever seen so many hazmat suits as like the last 2 years. Like, I don't think that was like part of like social imagery that I was seeing. And then also, like all the panic that's happening and all these like divisive YouTube type personalities who have like their shows about like we should just bomb them out of the sky and you know like all that kind of stuff, like they're here to destroy our way of life, you know, all those kinds of comments that have just been like so much in the atmosphere the last 4 years. And then also like we didn't talk about this part because it wasn't part of my emotional journey, but there is the couple of soldiers that decide to sort of break rank and out of fear or out of some sort of, I don't know, machismo. I'm not sure like what motivates them to try and destroy the creatures and destroy the ship. Thankfully they get foiled, but
they end up killing one of the aliens though.
Yes, they do end up.
It's such a sad moment when, like, that was a surprising emotional moment when the other heptapod, she's finally like in their actual presence, and we're getting subtitles for the first time of their language, and she says, they name Abbott and Costello. She's like, where's Abbott? And he says, Abbott is death process, and it's like, oh my gosh, yeah, that was I didn't expect that either this time. I had forgotten that happens, I think, but yeah, I didn't mean to derail you.
No, absolutely. That is like one of those like definitely tearjerker moments. I like that there's no like past tense of died because, you know, in their like everything at once way of thinking, like right now he's in that process of death, but, you know, also they know.
Then I guess he knew that was going to happen too, right, which is interesting, and still chose to come and give this gift to humanity despite I'm still realizing what's going on in this movie right now.
There's a lot of layers there. It's like kind of surprising actually. But that sort of like very I'm gonna do the right thing for the American people on my own sort of drive for those soldiers that made that choice, I think at the time it seemed more like, oh, like maybe that would happen, but then, you know, post January 6th, 2021, you're like, oh no, like this is really what people do.
My reaction to that was like, this would have happened right at the beginning. Like we wouldn't have given them this much benefit of the doubt, I guess, if we were afraid they could kill us or whatever. But like, I was like, I don't think this would go on so long without the military jumping way in there. Anyway.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Cynical view of
it. Well, thank you so much, Bethany, for selecting this film. Do you have any final thoughts about it before we wrap up?
I think we've covered a lot. That was probably more than I've talked about any single film in a while. I will just sort of hearken back to my sort of first thought with this, which is how powerful it is to sometimes turn off like the critical brain when interacting with film and just allow yourself to go on the experience of it. I'm sort of infamous in my friend group for having my own interpretation of films or books or whatever. And I came to a place of really accepting that. Like, it can mean something to you and it can be a deeply emotional experience for you without maybe being like the interpretation or like the most critical lens. And to, you know, allow movies to be magic sometimes and allow them to take you places you didn't know you needed to go.
I love that so much. And honestly, that's sort of like the mission of my podcast. The reason I say like the Snob Free Film Podcast is because I recognize that there are many times that I felt a film critic has yucked my yum, if to use a funny phrase, like, oh, I love this movie. And then now I feel bad about liking it. I never wanted do that to anyone else, but always want to leave the space for someone else to have the magic, even if I didn't, you know? So I love that. And thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing so much personal stuff and bringing so many wonderful thoughts about this film. I liked this film before, but now it's raised in my estimation quite a bit. So I'm really excited. It's one that I think I need to like have a copy on my shelf kind of thing. So anyway, thank you again so much. We'll have to have you back for a regular film discussion sometime. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you. It's been really fun, and I'm really looking forward to the future guests as well. I love hearing people answer this question.
Oh, good. Great. Big, big thanks to Bethany for her insights and vulnerability. I love chatting with her, and I hope she will come back soon. And that is it for this episode. Stay tuned next time. The rough plan at this point is a Matrix discussion and a review of the new film, Cyrano. But that is all subject to change. And that does it for this episode of Arthouse Garage. Thank you so much for listening. We've got a few years worth of episodes now, and you can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. Learn more at www.appallingproductions.com or find a link in the show notes. If you want to support Arthouse Garage, leave a rating or review in your podcast app, or you can buy an Arthouse Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. Stay in the loop about Arthouse Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter. That's at arthousegarage.com/subscribe, or you can email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Arthouse Garage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening. And until next time, keep it snob free.